You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. This is episode 23. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to We Are STS. We sampled undergraduate projects in a previous episode. Now it's time for the master's students. Today's episode offers a sampler of student-made projects. These were created by master's students in our science journalism module run by Dr. Jean-Baptiste Guyon. The assignment was straightforward. Imagine you're working for a radio news magazine. Create a 3-minute feature about a recent piece of research at UCL. Students have a tight deadline, and they have to work pretty much with the tools they have through their phone and their laptop. The goal is to mimic real-world work as a freelance journalist. The assignments students do in STS modules today are nothing like what they used to be. These days, they build portfolios of all sorts of things. Short writing, long writing, posters, blogs, in-class presentations. Add to these projects like podcasts, film clips, campaign strategies, briefing papers, debates, and proposals. We diversify our curriculum because we're training for a flexible future, a world of work that is as varied as we can imagine. For today, I've brought together 8 of the student projects that appeal to me. They're varied and they deliver the assignment in quite different ways. Think of this episode as a sampler. Details about each track are in the show notes. We'll take a break halfway through, so let's get started. I'll just sit back, roll the tapes, and I'll see you on the other side.
Welcome to Digital Society. In this episode, we are looking at new research into tackling far-right extremism online. To learn more, I spoke with Dr. Kiana Donovan, who has been looking at this issue in his native Ireland.
So my name is Kiana Donovan. I am a senior research fellow at UCL's Department of Science and Technology Studies. I study innovation, policy and politics. That means I'm interested in who decides what innovation policies the world needs, who pays for them and who benefits them.
So what does your work on far-right activity look like in practice?
It deals with some of the results of the huge power imbalances between really powerful monopolistic firms that essentially are multinational, they're transnational, and are very good at evading governance.
You say you use a harms first approach. What does this look like?
This starts with communities like LGBTQ+, whose members have really have been at the cold front of this, right?
What difference does digital make? And what role does it play in far-right activity?
The speed and the depth to which, say, digital platforms help move and circulate discourse. It's the way in which, say, mainstream political actors can tap into the discourses, the frames that we see by the far-right actors on YouTube, in Telegram, and repeat them in the real world. In a way, these discourses are, you know, so easily bleed into our homes and our workplaces.
So what actions have you taken? And how do tech firms respond to your work?
When we go in and try and talk to different organizations like Facebook, Twitter, Google, we get very different responses. Some of them engage and are genuinely interested, I think, in helping. Others aren't.
Many people assume digital technologies are new and that we're still trying to figure out how to engage with them and govern them.
There's a lot of questions there. We still treat digital technologies as really emergent and novel and new. They're not. They've been with us a long time and we need to get a grip on that.
Before you go, how do we move forward? What is next for research in this area?
We need better knowledge circulation, and we need to work with our funders and our institutional organisations too to help steer some of this research, that we don't simply accept the powerful incumbent digital platforms version of the future, but we say, hey, the future belongs to all of us. We all get a say in this.
And with that, I'd like to thank Kian for sharing his work. Tune in to the next episode, where we will be exploring the impact of social media on mental health.
Welcome back to another episode of Space Odyssey, where understanding space is not beyond one's reach. Stars have always fascinated humans, and understanding their life cycle is one of the keys to knowing more about the universe. At the end of a star's life, it can either become a white dwarf, black hole, or a neutron star. Recent research conducted at UCL, spearheaded by Professor Jay Farihi, has in the first time discovered planetary bodies in the habitable zone of a white dwarf. We will talk to Andrew, one of the team members involved in the research, to know more about this.
I'm Andrew Swan, a postdoctoral researcher at UCL, working on white dwarf planetary systems.
So what exactly are white dwarfs? And in what way is it beneficial to understanding our solar system?
So a white dwarf is the final stage in a star's life. Most stars will end up this way. And a good analogy to understand what they are is that of a fire. A star is a massive fire. It burns until one day it runs out of fuel. And then you're just left with the embers. A white dwarf is the ember of a star. So our sun will become a white dwarf in about 5 billion years. And like most stars, it has planets, and so we should expect planets to appear around most white dwarfs.
Considering there are planets in a white dwarf system, what was the procedure that you followed to find the planets in the habitable zone of a white dwarf?
So most planets have been discovered through chance alignments where they pass in front of their star, and we see the slight dimming in the star's light. So knowing that white dwarfs ought to host planetary systems, we went looking for the same. And after surveying dozens of systems, we struck gold and found one where not a planet, but large clouds of debris were orbiting the star. Their orbit placed them in the habitable zone where liquid water could exist. But the really remarkable thing about these debris clouds is that they carry like a gravitational barcode that suggests that they're associated with a nearby planet. This is similar to how Saturn's rings have a complex pattern on them that's related to Saturn's moons.
Understanding the cosmos would definitely be difficult, but what kind of difficulties that your team encountered during this discovery?
So the big difficulty when looking for stuff passing in front of another star is that it has to be lined up just so, and in most cases it won't be, so you'll miss it. That gives you a huge challenge because telescope time is very limited. So you're constrained in how many stars you can survey and how long you can look at them for. And that introduces a big element of luck into the project.
Ultimately, could you summarize your research?
So this discovery means that for the first time, we've got tantalizing evidence that there's a planet in the habitable zone of a white dwarf. And that's really exciting because it's another small step on the way to searching for and hopefully discovering life outside the solar system.
Universe has so many questions yet to be answered, and we are answering one question at a time. And thank you, Andrew, for giving a glimpse of it.
Hello and welcome to Sustainable Living, your favorite podcast for learning about the best ways you and your family can lead a sustainable and healthy lifestyle. In this week's segment, we're going to talk about plant-based diets and if they're healthy for our children. In recent years, climate change activists and sustainability practitioners have been advocating for plant-based diets to reduce our impact on the environment. But at what age should these diets be implemented, and what impact can they have on the healthy development of our children? Today we have Professor Jonathan Wells here with us to help make sense of some of these questions.
I'm Jonathan Wells, and I'm Professor of Anthropology and Pediatric Nutrition at UCL Great Ormond Street Institute of Child Health.
Professor Wells recently steered a study that examined the health effects of plant-based diets for children. For this study, Professor Wells and his team analyzed health markers in 187 children who had been following either vegan, vegetarian, or omnivore diets for over 5 years.
We looked across a basket of potential benefits and potential risks, and that made, I think, the project more useful to the public, because we could try and say what was good, but also what might need attention in these diets.
After the study was conducted and the data was analyzed, some really interesting findings were uncovered.
We concluded that you could find some benefits and you could find some risks pretty much of all three of the diet groups, which I think was quite interesting. So if we found, for example, that the vegetarian and the vegan children didn't do so well for some particular outcome, then what we're also saying is that the omnivores did better. However, we found, for example, that the vegan children had lower markers of some cardiometabolic risk traits, and that seemed to be quite closely associated with the fact that they had lower levels of body fat. We probably found that the vegetarians in some ways look the least healthy group. And I think the reason for that is that just eating a vegetarian diet doesn't mean that you're eating a healthy diet. It's possible to eat ice cream, pizza, and chocolate. That would all be vegetarian. It doesn't mean it's a balanced, nutrient-rich diet. So, and I think that was quite interesting in the context of children. So probably one of the biggest findings we have is that the diet isn't healthy or not just because it's got the label vegetarian or vegan or omnivore. You still have to ask, what are the foods that you're eating?
It sounds like the bottom line is each of these diets have their advantages and disadvantages. But what's most important is that we eat a balanced, nutrients-rich diet. However, what do parents need to consider if their children choose to become vegan or vegetarian?
The more food groups you leave out, probably the more important it is to supplement on some of the well-known nutrients, which can include vitamin B12 and vitamin D and sometimes iron.
Well, thank you, Professor Wells, for joining us today and shedding some light on this fascinating subject. And thank you to all our listeners out there. I hope you join us next time to learn more about sustainable living.
Today, the focus is on new research conducted at UCL on sex differences. It suggests that it might finally be time to embrace the complexity of gender and sex in medical science. I had a chance to receive insights from scientist Freya Pentis, who published in November 2021 a meta-analysis which confirmed the existence of consistent sex differences in cardiac interoceptive accuracy, which is defined as the ability to correctly perceive internal signals arising from the body. Now, you might wonder, what does it mean, and why does that matter? In fact, interoception has been linked to a number of mental health conditions that are notorious for being more or less prevalent according to gender. Freya explained to me that understanding where those individual differences in interoceptions stem from might help us take better care of our society.
We're particularly looking at language and if the kind of language we use about bodily states and also emotional states might influence how men and women kind of develop this difference in interoception. And, you know, that is something that, you know, we can kind of change, and it has changed. You think now about how the language you might use with a young boy or a young girl is probably quite different from 50 years ago. So I think it's, you know, there's really big implications there for kind of our understanding and also like how we might kind of change something there.
Now let's step back in history for a minute. Women and men have always been treated differently by medicine, but this has not always been for the better. From measuring women's skulls to justify their inability to vote, all the way to excluding them from clinical trial due to their presumably complex biology, scientists have historically participated to the construction of gender and sex-based stereotypes. It's now 2022, and it's high time we, as a society, moved on from the men are from Mars, women are from Venus narrative to embrace the complexity. And scientists may help us do that. Freya published a comprehensive account of her complex research and its implication on the website The Conversation for the general public to access. She explained to me that she felt a certain level of responsibility to communicate about her work.
It's difficult then when you're communicating it, because you don't want it to just be like men and women are biologically different in the way that they like feel their body, because you know, that isn't really what we're saying. And I do think it's why there's a responsibility of researchers and scientists, particularly those working in possibly more kind of controversial areas or areas where often there are a lot of myths.
The physiological and psychosocial mechanism behind gender, sex and health are extremely complex. But according to this new research, embracing their complexity might help us care better for our community. Thank you for listening to Human Up and see you soon for more sex and gender related news.
I'm going to interrupt here. Let's take a short break.
What do I like about SDS? I like the diversity in the curriculum here. I like that we get to read authors from all over the world that really strays away from a very homogeneous form of thinking and allows me to be exposed to a different perspective in the history and philosophy of science. And just the culture as well. I think the department has a great culture and everyone's very supportive.
Let's get back to our sampler. We're halfway through. Four down and four to go. If you're tempted to give this type of work a try, just look us up. Search online for terms UCL, STS, and modules. This particular module uses the code HPSC0122. That's all in the show notes. Off we go to the second half.
Welcome to Radio Tonight. Although our communities have paid much attention to the pandemic, there is much less importance placed on those most vulnerable populations living and working in care homes. Currently, we do not know how many people in care homes are infected with COVID-19. Led by UCL professor Laura Shawgross, a national study is now launched to investigate COVID-19 infections in care homes. Although it is not easy to conduct the assessment, scientists believe the ratio of getting COVID for people in care homes is much higher.
But at least a third got in the first wave, but now it will be much, much higher than that, much higher. And particularly with Omicron, that we're still seeing outbreaks. So I think the majority of care homes will have had at least some cases. People have estimated 50% prevalence, maybe even higher. But one of the things that's tricky in care homes is because the patient is so old, the death rate's very high. And so you've got new people coming in and people dying. And so it's always changing. It's not like you have a population that's stable, that just stays in a care home.
Scientists also warn that vaccine effectiveness will possibly last for only 3 months. Hence, people in care homes will need to take additional vaccines regularly in order to provide more protections for them.
And then when they do have that booster, their protection goes back up again. But the problem is that it means that every time you have a vaccine, and then you need another vaccine and another vaccine, and yeah. That's obviously expensive. So at the moment, we need to keep vaccinating people in care homes, not necessarily every 3 months, but definitely regularly.
Although some news reported that the new variant Omicron is less severe, it is still essential to take a booster against Omicron for people in care homes.
And we found that you were less likely to die or to go to hospital if you got Omicron. They're less serious, great. But the problem is that people, just before Omicron arrived, everybody had their booster vaccine. And so it's really hard to know, is it the booster or is it Omicron? And so I think that it's becoming clearer that the booster was really important.
The study aims to inform decisions around the best approach to COVID-19 testing policy.
It's not clear at the moment because they're still trying to decide what to do in care homes. So they have changed testing for staff. They don't know if they're going to keep testing residents or not. They're looking at all sorts of other things they could do, so measuring COVID in water, wastewater, that kind of thing. All of these things will have an effect on our study, but what might happen is our study might end up being the surveillance tool, so the being used to provide information for all care homes. So then we might keep testing in our care homes, but not do it elsewhere. But none of this is decided yet.
Welcome to this week's episode of The Climate Society, the podcast that explores the latest research on how climate change is contributing to social inequalities. This week, we're talking to UCL's Paul Ekins, Professor of Resources and Environment Policy at the Bartlett School, about his research on how climate change impacts global food production and how this disproportionately impacts poorer countries and poorer people in richer countries.
The research was a project which was funded by the Grantham Foundation. The first was looking through a crop model, which is quite widely used. It's called the EPIC crop model. And we were incorporating in that for the first time soil erosion, particularly wind and water soil erosion. And another strand of the work was to do some econometric analysis on the relationship between crop yields in the past and two weather variables, namely temperature and precipitation. The third strand was to take the impact of soil erosion on crops and to feed that into a macroeconomic model to see what the overall macroeconomic impacts would be, both from the soil erosion and from any price changes that might arise from the second strand of the work.
Professor Ekins goes on to describe how weather events can impact local food production by using the example of the Arab Spring.
There have been crop failures in certain parts of the world at certain times, but because of these weather events, whether they're flooding or drought, prices have risen slightly. That, of course, has caused considerable problems in some part of the world. I mean, the whole Arab Spring discontents were sparked by rising food prices in Tunisia. So there have been issues to do with prices, rising food prices caused by localized shortages caused by crop failures.
So why does this disproportionately impact those in society who are already disadvantaged?
Obviously, the people who have been most impacted are the people who are poorest and they spend the highest proportion of their income on food, and therefore they're the ones who suffer. Richer people, they adapt, they obviously spend a little bit more on food, but they're able to do that because it's a rather small proportion of their incomes.
Finally, I asked Professor Ekins, as the consequences of climate change become more apparent, whose responsibility is it to mitigate any impacts on global food production?
It's the job of policymakers at all levels, researchers, but also farmers themselves, the kind of farming that they practice, to actually try to resolve some of these issues. It's complicated, it's not easy, but it is, you know, one of this great set of problems that's all interlinked between climate change, the availability of food, the availability of water, and the availability of nature and biodiversity. And they're all intricately linked together.
Welcome to Mindset, a podcast dedicated to understanding mental health from different perspectives. In this episode, we will be talking with Elise Paul.
I'm Dr. Elise Paul, and I'm a senior research fellow in epidemiology and statistics at University College London, and I work on the UCL COVID-19 social study.
The COVID-19 social study is the largest scientific research on the psychological and social impact of the pandemic in the UK. From March 2020, the project has conducted 1.2 million surveys involving more than 70,000 people. So, why mental health has become a crucial issue for research these days?
Well, mental health is known more and more as being linked to physical health and is gaining as much attention and importance as physical health. Indeed, the two are linked. Mental health disorders are leading causes of days lived with disability in higher income countries, and this is increasing in lower income countries.
In this context, it's also important to know the most vulnerable groups in terms of mental health during the pandemic. So let's find what Elise has to say.
So young adults, the ages 18 to 29, have been affected most in terms of their mental health, anxiety, depression symptoms. Also women who have had to disproportionately pick up the slack, particularly when there are children in the home, sort of dual roles of having to work at home, do more of the housework, and educate children from home, as well as people with lower incomes. You know, pandemic brought quite a few financial adversities, as well as the threat of financial adversities.
Nowadays, the pandemic is no longer a critical issue compared to 2020. In this context, have the mental health rates improved or worsened?
Overall, levels of depression and anxiety symptoms in our study are still higher than what we would expect pre-pandemic, even though we don't have pre-pandemic data. I don't think it's reasonable for, you know, given the extent of the situation, that everyone's mental health would bounce back so quickly. I think it is going to take time and there will be repercussions.
Well, it seems that mental health remains a social concern. What kind of actions could scientific research develop to address this issue?
As an epidemiologist, I can say that continued monitoring of these issues at the population level is essential for identifying which groups are most at risk, for monitoring their health behaviors, their health-seeking behaviors, and their mental health. So this step is critical in managing, preventing, and treating mental health.
In conclusion, population monitoring could be essential to understanding some of the leading mental health issues in the UK. However, this topic will likely continue to raise questions for scientific research. Many thanks for listening. We will meet soon here in Mindset.
Hello and welcome to Brainwave, the podcast that brings you weekly updates in neuroscience research. In this episode, we'll be looking at research into the mental health of children and young adults who stammer. Stammering is a neurodevelopmental condition most often commencing in childhood. It can be characterized by disrupted speech fluency, including repetitions, blocks, and prolongations. Earlier, I spoke with Ria Bernard, clinical speech therapist and researcher at UCL, to gain some of her insights.
A lot of the time when you talk about stammering, there's still a lot of stereotypes about it. There's a lot of misconceptions that individuals are nervous or they're shy or they have a particular sort of personality.
Ria spoke of how individuals with a stammer are often lumped together as if they exist in one homogenous group with one universal experience, an assumption which her and other experts in the field ardently reject.
I had children that I worked with who, you know, they were very shy. They didn't want to put their hand up in the class. They wanted to find ways around speaking in front of lots of people. And I had other children who at the age of like 9 or 10 would say, well, it's just a lump it. This is how I speak.
So there have been several studies, including Ria's, that suggest that children who stammer are more likely to develop symptoms of anxiety. But what seems to be important in our pursuit to help these children is the consideration that anxiety is not an inherent quality of stammering, but might be a result of the social perceptions of stammering.
So maybe it isn't the stammer that increases risk on its own. Maybe it's actually a multitude of different things. There's quite a lot of evidence to show that children who stammer are likely to be bullies. And that bullying may well be associated with their speech. And bullying in itself, outside of stammering, is associated with adverse mental health.
I was interested to hear Ria's thoughts on the social assumption that people with a stammer wish that they didn't have it, and whether treatment for stammering plays off this idea.
There is certainly, I think, a feeling in the community amongst adults that sometimes there's too much emphasis on the fluency and the kind of speech motor aspects. But my view has always been, it's up to the individual. I think one of the big differences is age. Working with children, I often found that children wanted to work on their speech fluency, whereas older individuals may want to work more on the emotional side.
my conversation with Ria, it became clear that the relationship between anxiety and stammering is complex. Ria hopes that her research will one day improve treatment for children with a stammer. Her full paper is available in the Journal of Speech, Language and Hearing Research if you want to find out more. For now, I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Thank you for listening to Brainwave.
You know, I listen to these and I think, well done, everybody. It's such a joy to hear the finished projects. Thanks to the students for their work. And a special thanks to those agreeing to be interviewed. You know, it's easy to say no when a student knocks on your door asking for help. But far more often, researchers at UCL, well, they just welcome students in and give up their time. We just couldn't do projects like these without their help. So from all of us here in STS, a giant thank you. If you know someone who might like to study with us, just ask them to get in touch. Maybe it's philosophy of science, or sociology, or science policy, or maybe, just maybe, it's to study history of science, like me. They all fit under the umbrella of Science and Technology Studies, or STS. Music today included two pieces, Rollinette 5 and Laconic Granny, both by Kevin MacLeod, and both are available online at the website filmmusic.com. You also heard Roha Ali Khan, one of our master's students from last year. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to find out more about the show, or listen to past episodes, or even give us some feedback, visit us online. Here's the address. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. That's it for today. Thanks to you for coming along, and we'll have another episode ready soon. So until next time, everybody, don't forget, there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere, and that together, we are STS. Bye now, and Happy New Year! You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.